For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging.
And so what we know is often the biggest disappointment to patients is that they get the information about fertility preservation options as they are going to start the treatment. And if you tell them as they're going to stop, in their mind, they're already ready to start cancer treatment. So they're like, well, hold on a minute. One, why wasn't I told before? And two, I've actually now prepared myself for starting cancer treatment, so I don't want to delay that. And three, talking about delays, if you start the process earlier, there's less chance of actually having delays.
That was the voice of Dr. Antoinette Anizzotto, a paediatric haematologist and oncologist who is an advocate for fertility preservation for people undergoing treatment for cancer. Dr. Anizzotto and a large group of colleagues recently developed new Australian fertility preservation guidelines for the Clinical Oncology Society of Australia, a summary of which was published in the MJA. I'm delighted to have Dr. Anizzotto, Dr. Violet Q, who is the lead author of the guidelines, and another co-author, Professor Kate Stern from the Royal Women's Hospital in Melbourne, as my special guests today. Thanks, ladies, for joining me. And we're going to talk about fertility preservation and new guidelines for such. Fertility preservation, are we talking about all people of childbearing age with cancer, or is it only certain types of cancer or certain types of treatments where fertility preservation should be a conversation?
First of all, you have to define what fertility preservation is. And, and we know that fertility preservation is a term used to describe the science and technology of preserving fertility. Part of that preservation is actually the discussion and selection of patients. And so I think in 2022, what we realize is that every patient and their partners, carers, parents deserve the information about risk. And that risk may be no risk at all, low risk, intermediate risk, high risk, and increasingly with new novel therapies, it may be unknown risk. And so that's the first stage. And then the next stage is the referral process. So understanding who's at risk and referring them to specialists who have the expertise in discussing in more detail what fertility preservation options are available and doing the procedures. And this is where the sticking point is, because we know internationally and in Australia, less than 50% of patients and their partners, carers, parents are given information about their risk and fertility preservation options. So that's quite significant that half of cancer patients are never told about this.
So all cancer patients should have this conversation?
I would say yes, because I think there are patients who then hear about fertility later on, and then they realise that they haven't had the conversation and they worry that they're at risk, when there's a good cohort of patients who have no risk and there's also patients who have risk. When we talk about chemotherapy side effects or treatment side effects more broadly, doctors usually go through the risks. And, you know, it's very unusual for them not to do that in a systematic, broad way. I guess what Kate and I are saying, and other clinicians, is it's important to tell people what the risk of fertility, infertility is, even if there's no risk, so that, patients know. And that's really important for childbearing. There are some people who think, oh, I'm going to be infertile, and then they have unprotected sex and whoops, you know, either during or after they have babies that they hadn't planned for. So it's important in that way. And then it's important for people who are at risk to have options for a biological child if it's possible in the future.
Let's say it's a child we're talking about who has the cancer, a prepubescent child. Is it still important to have that conversation with the kid's parents, carers, etc.?
Yeah, I would say it's just as important for prepubertal children. And so that discussion, one, gives families and the child, if they're at a sort of health literacy age where they can understand concepts, yep. even in a basic way, to make decisions. And if, in the case of males, it's research related fertility preservation, it gives them ideas about options or things that could be done at a later time. And if you don't have information, you're not empowered to have choice either yeah. before treatment or later on. And that's why it's important.
What kinds of cancer treatments are a threat to fertility?
When we think about risk, we talk about the gonadotoxic risk. So basically, it's saying what is toxic to our reproductive organs or the hormones that are involved in reproduction. There are various tables called risk tables mm-hmm. that put patients into a high risk, intermediate, low, or no risk. So yeah. the things that are high risk are drugs like alkylating agents that affect the gonadal tissue. And it's not just the drugs, it's the dose of the drug as well. Yes. So we know that the higher the alkylating dose, the more likely it is to cause problems. The timing, so we know that if you are older and you have gonadotoxic drugs, when your reproductive tissues are older, especially for women, it's going to mm-hmm. have more of an effect than when you're younger. We also know that other types of treatment, like radiotherapy to the reproductive organs or to the brain, where there's the hormones that are important for reproduction, can have an effect. And then there's this unknown, and the unknown are these new novel agents, so the immunotherapy agents, small molecule agents, where we are currently doing research to look at what their gonadotoxic effects are. And yeah. there's only 4 or 5 case reports, and those case reports are slightly mixed, but are giving us some early information that these new novel agents may indeed have an effect on fertility.
Complicated and quickly evolving, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, these new novel agents, what we're doing is we're getting information about acute effects, but many people who respond to these novel agents are going to be what we call chronic cancer patients. So their disease is controlled by these agents, and they continue to have small doses for long periods of time. And so what we're going to have to do is do studies like we have open, where they are looking at reproduction over periods of time to see, one, do the agents have any effect? And two, at what dose does that effect happen, if it's going to happen? And given that there's so many classes of new novel agents, that's quite a big undertaking in terms of research. What we say is the first thing is to have a discussion with the oncologist and ask for a referral to a fertility specialist. Yeah. That's important because there are, you know, some cases, there's a lot of more animal data where we can look and say, okay, based on what we know, what the risk is. We don't want to be in a situation where we over-medicalize and over-treat patients. And fertility preservation is not a benign thing to do, especially for female patients.
Invasive, but, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's very invasive. It's expensive. It has, you know, the hormonal effects on the body. And then there's the psychological effects as well. So, you know, it's not something that we want everyone to rush into, but we do want early referrals before treatment starts. Yep. We want patients to sign up for studies looking at new novel agents, even if they don't have fertility preservation, because that's the only way we're going to learn about these drugs. We want patients who already know that they have gynecological problems or male infertility problems to be talking about those things, because when we talk about the risks, it's not just the risks of your fertility treatment, it's the risks of the fertility treatment plus any other underlying risk. So, for example, if you're a young woman who has endometriosis, we know that endometriosis on its own has problems associated with infertility. Yeah. So the two things combined together may actually increase the risk of you being infertile. Having a doctor that is thinking through you as an individual rather than, oh, this treatment's unlikely to be a problem, is really important. And again, that's another reason why I think it's really important that patients go to clinicians with expertise yes. in assessing risk.
You mentioned that only about half of cancer patients are having these conversations with their doctors. Is that a symptom of the technology advancing really quickly, or is there some other barrier at work that's stopping these conversations from happening?
There's multiple reasons. When you think about the technology, it's not new technology. Mm-hmm. IVF therapies have been around for more than 40 years now, and the same technologies are used for cancer patients as for non-cancer patients. In terms of why are patients not told, I think there's multiple reasons. I think that for some who have no risk or low risk, their clinicians are potentially being paternalistic and saying, do you know what, that's something they can think about at a later time, or don't have to worry them about things that there's no risk about. Not thinking that young people now are actually very health literate and are beginning to think about this. So we know that 25% of all referrals are made because a family member has brought it up. So people are hearing about these things, mm-hmm. and they're saying, oh, hold on, has your doctor mentioned it? So that's number one. Number two is that traditionally IVF therapies have been expensive. Yeah. And again, people don't bring it up because they think, well, it's very expensive for patients. We don't want to bother them, especially when they know the background of their patients. So again, very paternalistic. Mm-hmm. Number three is that some hospitals are not really equipped to have IVF services, and that means there's an additional logistics in getting patients outside to clinics or hospitals that have these services. So it's the practicalities. We know that internationally, less than 10% of services have a referral pathway for fertility care. So that's really important. If you don't have Dr. A, who's an oncologist or a hematologist, who knows Dr. B, who is a fertility specialist, that's another barrier. Then you've got the rural barriers. So we know that basically a lot of the IVF services are in metropolitan Sydney. And so our rural regional patients don't have access to them. But they're the big ones. And, you know, they're the things that we're trying to look for solutions. And then I guess the last big thing is education. So we know that fertility risk, sexuality, gender are not topics that are taught traditionally in medical schools and nursing schools, maybe a little bit more. And so it hasn't actually yet got into syllabuses, which means we've got healthcare providers that have to be taught as they are doing their training. And we know how difficult that is, one, actually teaching people, but two, we have a healthcare group that are always moving. Junior doctors change, nurses change, allied health professionals change. And so having that sustained knowledge is really quite critical in ensuring that you have really fluid referral pathways. We know internationally there's 31 guidelines about fertility preservations.
Yes.
And so it's not because there's a lack of information, it's how you implement that information and how you develop models of care so that knowledge can be part of everyday systems.
I think actually we have had some scientific advances in the last 5 or so years, and I think it does take a while for the medical community to catch up. I think egg freezing is not considered experimental now, and we've now had success around the world with tissue freezing. For postpubertal girls, there's now increasing interest in tissue freezing for prepubertal boys, which is, of course, experimental, and girls. But there's been a sort of a paradigm shift in understanding that these options may be useful, and I think there is always a big delay. That's one thing. And I think also to just follow on from Antoinette, education of our healthcare communities outside the major metropolitan services, it just takes a while. I mean, when we started doing fertility preservation, Antoinette did some amazing work. You know, less than 5%, 15 years ago, less than 5% of patients were having the discussions, whereas we think that we're getting up to 50% now. So I think that two of the really big barriers have been just not getting enough time advancing the understanding about these techniques that are now innovative but not experimental, and being able to upskill our healthcare professionals, particularly in rural regional areas. As Antoinette said, in rural and regional areas where egg freezing is sort of available most places, as is sperm freezing, but ovarian tissue freezing or testicular tissue freezing is very specific. It requires very specialised techniques. It's quite complicated. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't been available. So in rural and regional centres, the specialists may not have thought about talking about it with their patients. We've now got a national transport program which facilitates transport, and it means that patients in rural and regional areas can make a call to the central centre. And we have one in Melbourne, and Antoinette's unit does it as well. And we can actually organise transport of tissue to come to the central unit. With respect to public fertility, even before truly public IVF was available for cancer patients, we have, over the last 10 to 15 years, had services where we've been able to provide care, and we hope that no one would ever have missed out on this care because of finances. But I think Violet and Antoinette can talk to you about our public services.
Violet, you want to have a crack at that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Melbourne at the Royal Women's Hospital, we have a fertility preservation stream, and we have a dedicated fertility preservation nurse coordinator. So from a referral, it is of the utmost importance, and we aim to see people within 24, 48 hours. It can be a very compressed time for patients and their families, and you know, anecdotally, seeing young women having to deal with their cancer and fertility considerations, we can see that there's a lot to think about. Do they freeze eggs? Do they have a partner? Is this a partner they want to convert to embryos? What about ovarian tissue? And the other issues are return to their period. And what about natural fertility later on? You know, sexual identity and contraception in the future. And I've seen, you know, very, very smart young women have to deal with so much at once. And so that leads into like sort of education. So even at our unit, we have a lot of written information on our website. We have PDFs on all the different chemotherapy effects, radiation effects, and also radiation effects on the uterus and being able to carry a pregnancy in the future. Mm-hmm. And perhaps a bit later, I can discuss more about new ways of education that we've been introducing, videos as well, mm-hmm. For patients, so that they have a tool that they can access anywhere. It's web-based, so it doesn't matter if you're rural or regional. We've got subtitles for different languages, so it's culturally and linguistically diverse. And we've involved patients, carers, and support groups in the development, so co-created these videos as well.
I'm chatting with Dr. Violet Kew, Professor Kate Stern, and Dr. Antoinette Anazzotto, who are co-authors of the new Australian Fertility Preservation Guidelines for people undergoing treatment for cancer. Their summary of the guidelines is published by the MJA, and the full guidelines are available at Cancer Council Australia's website. Both links are in the show notes to this podcast. If you're enjoying this podcast and would like to hear more, you can find all our previous episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. And you can subscribe to future episodes through your favourite podcast platform by searching for Medical Journal of Australia. Back to our chat.
In Victoria and New South Wales, and really around Australia, public services are provided. Antoinette's unit was the first truly public unit, and we've now received funding in Victoria. But around Australia, finances should not be a barrier for a patient accessing fertility preservation.
Is it important to time this conversation?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because doing fertility preservation options such as egg or embryo freeze isn't immediate. If you think about a female, you know, the average woman's fertility cycle, that's four weeks of a period, and the first 2 weeks are growing the eggs. So you need at least 2 weeks to stimulate and mature eggs. So by the time they've been referred, have informed consent, and that's where it's critical to give open information about the pros, cons, risks and alternatives, and for them to come back, collect their medicines. And whilst they're concurrently thinking about chemo and scheduling that in, It's also about when are they going to do the injections, do the pelvic ultrasounds to look at their ovaries, look at their follicles, do blood tests and come into theatre under a sedation to collect their eggs. And then they wonder about, you know, numbers. Mm-hmm. What does my blood result say? What does this AMH, anti-müllerian hormone, say? How many do I need to do? And then it sort of builds up as well in terms of other things that people have said to them. So having clear information from the public hospital, let's say, puts many people on the page, so they may come in with their parents and partners if they have them.
I mean, as an oncologist, I guess I've got a different take in that for most cancers, you know, they don't start their cancer treatment immediately. Mm. Even leukemias, you know, you've got a 3 to 5-7 day window before cancer treatment starts. And so the key for me as an oncologist is trying to balance the information needed to make a diagnosis, the information needed to do all the toxicity assessment. So fertility preservation is one, but it also there's the echoes for your heart safety, there's the hearing test, there's the lung function test, there's the GFRs, and patients may have one of these things or they may have multiple. And so for me as an oncologist, it's the organisation of testing and the early referrals. And so what we know is often the biggest disappointment to patients is that they get the information about fertility preservation options as they are going to start the treatment. And if you tell them as they're going to start, in their mind, they're already getting ready already to start cancer treatment. So they're like, well, hold on a minute. One, why wasn't I told before? And two, I've actually now prepared myself for starting cancer treatment, so I don't want to delay that. And three, talking about delays, if you start the process earlier, there's less chance of actually having delays. And we've done some work showing that there really is a 1 or 2 day difference for most patients when you have an early referral. And so that comes back to what are the things that make early referrals? And one is models of care. The teams like the ones that we work with have referral pathways. They have good coordination between cancer and fertility specialists. They have nurses who provide support across the different specialties. And that's really important because they act as a navigator, they help with decision making, and then there's the psychological support staff who help with the fertility related distress. And we know that if you have those things in place, one, you have more people opting into fertility preservation choices, and two, even if you don't, if you decide that you don't want to have fertility preservation, one, you have the education so you can come back to it later on. Two, there's data showing that patient satisfaction is better, which is really important. And then number three is the fertility-related psychological distress is lower in those patients who have early information and referrals. So I think that's, as an oncologist, it's different. I think Violet spoke as, you know, someone who's referred to her, then she has the sort of difficulty of deciding, one, what are the patient's risks going to be and how quickly can we do fertility preservation and what are the options? And one option that she talked about was egg and embryo, but there are a few other options now for women. The ovarian tissue, which Kate spoke about, which can be done more quickly. And then there's some research types like we call it in vitro maturation, which can also be done more quickly. So I think it's talking through different options. Not all the options are available in all the centres. People choices as well.
Over recent years, we've developed relationships between our haematologists and oncologists and our fertility specialists. Yep. And it's now fabulous because if you have aware oncologists and haematologists, they will refer the patients early and then we will see patients within 1 or 2 days. And, you know, these patients, they always turn up to these appointments. They're always so grateful. And one of the very powerful things is if a patient is referred by their cancer doctor to talk about fertility, the message to that patient is, you know what, it's worth talking about this because you're going to be okay. Good likelihood you're going to be okay. That's a very powerful motivating tool for our patients. And we really, I think that we've got such great coordination in the bigger centres now, where we can manage to see patients, and the patients always want to come and have the chat. Actually, they may not need fertility preservation, or it may not be appropriate, but they really, they're linked into the system for future discussion, and they have very much appreciated getting the information. But we establish the relationship, and we're really good now together in our coordination with our hematologist oncologist colleagues to see our patients, inform them, give them as much time as they need within the realms of what's possible.
I would say to that definitely working in a team is number one, and so would be very much guided by what is safe practice in terms of the time gap between the referral from oncology and what we would offer. So in that time, if there was a turnaround of a few days, we talk about different options such as the laparoscopy, keyhole surgery, and mm-hmm. the pros and cons of the ovarian tissue. And certainly the relationship is so important from the clinician to the patient, because there are other considerations, for example, genetic testing, even that discussion, for example, of patients if they're BRCA, so if they have a breast cancer associated gene, if we are able or discuss the pros and cons of eggs and embryos and then doing further genetic testing, so pre-implantation genetic testing for monogenetic diseases, this involves another way of taking care of them for the future and for future generations.
Yeah. So let's talk about the guidelines themselves. What's changed in the latest set?
First of all, we wanted to update the guidelines. 2010 we did them. A lot has changed in terms of access, uptake, utilization of fertility preservation and the types of fertility preservation now that are seen as standard of care. The first COSA guidelines were really for post-pubertal patients, young adults and our adult patients. And these ones have now included chapters for our children and pre-pubertal patients. When the guidelines were first written, there was no information about novel agents, immunotherapy. And while there isn't a lot of data, we have some information about what should be done for those patients. And then there's sections that we obviously were important but weren't included previously, and that was the survivorship questions. So managing symptoms, following a cancer diagnosis, the sexuality, menstruation, and follow-up. So, you know, I think all in all, we've not only updated the work that was already in the guidelines, but we've added new chapters that I think are really important from a infertility, but also a reproductive health perspective.
These guidelines now are very comprehensive. And even like, as Antoinette said, there are 31 international guidelines, but now these guidelines cover from year dosh onwards throughout reproductive life and reproductive health as well. So they are very comprehensive now.
Two things. You've asked specifically about what's been updated, and we've done a dot point of four things, but some of the things to update are the vitrification, so the fast freeze. Our technology of actually freezing eggs as large single cells has vastly improved in the success rate of successful thaw. And so that was only not experimental in 2012. Mm. So the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. So that's new in the last 10 years or so. And the pregnancy rates are on par with frozen embryos. And also in terms of how new things are, the first successful ovarian tissue graft was in 2005, so it's less than 20 years. And so while it's no longer experimental, oversight's required because the data isn't there for those who are sort of under that 20-year age group. And the second thing is really to plug teamwork again. So I've mentioned videos. So it's called Fertility After Cancer. And this is actually in conjunction with the Western and Central Melbourne Integrated Cancer Service, but with their larger networks, and that's the strength of having clear communication, we've been able to link in with, say, the Cancer Council. So it's not just a Melbourne-based thing. So if any patients or family members want to discuss fertility, they can call the 13 11 20 number and speak to a cancer nurse. And behind the scenes, we've developed a working platform so that they can link in the patient or family member to the actual hospital and resource in their state. It's local, hyperlocal, so you're not getting information that is it not relevant to you?
First of all, I just want to thank you for having us on this podcast.
Our pleasure.
Fertility preservation is so important. And as we said before, cancer affects so many young people, 1 in 500 young people, and everybody knows someone with cancer. There are just a couple of other things that I think we should all be really proud of that have happened in the last few years. And one is we've got increased data about fertility preservation. It's not so ad hoc and casual now. Antoinette really has done an amazing job. She's led this with her Future Fertility website and the Oncofertility Registry. So we now have much more buy-in from around the country, and that just raises awareness on its own, as well as the benefit of actually inputting data. So we can now go to government with much more accurate data rather than, oh, well, in my unit. So that's really important. Yeah. The second thing is the availability now of information available to everyone. Now, Violet's done some amazing videos. We've done some not quite so amazing videos. I do want you to put that in because mine are really crap. When we did ours and then we saw, and then Violet did hers. We went, yep, that's what we do. Antoinette's group have done some amazing patient education information. And so now there's more information, and that is going to help inform our patients, their families, and our health professionals. Now, we hope that all medical practitioners will really embrace understanding more about fertility preservation, but it's also really important that patients and families have more access to information.
When we think about survivorship, people often, so clinicians often think about life after cancer treatment, mm-hmm. but this is one time when survivorship has to start at diagnosis. If you leave it till after diagnosis, there's still options, but those options may not be as good mm-hmm. as having biological tissue that's collected. So I guess my message to clinicians who are listening to this is to, there's lots of ways to become more educated about fertility preservation, options, risks, and choices. So starting with the guidelines is a really good way. There are lots of centres now that are being really proactive mm-hmm. when it comes to fertility preservation. I'd encourage more centres. All cancer centres should have a model of care for fertility preservation. It's really important to know who the fertility provider is. And then lastly, you know, while it seems easy in terms of costs in those centres that don't have public access, Medicare does cover some of these things. That difficulties for some patients is if they don't have the money, they can't start. And I think there are a number of charities that are looking at providing assistance. So they should ask the nurse consultants, the social workers, the oncologists, haematologists, where they can go to for support.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.